Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with the weather, and I am not happy about it. And I'd like to be very clear about that. It was almost 70 degrees out just 2 days ago, and now this cold, wet, heavy, and like for the third time in less than a month. I have been looking for someone to blame, and since I can't talk to the weather directly, we have an idea of who to blame instead. It goes a little like this.
The snow. Knows on. The snow. Knows on. No.
Did you hear what she said there? Bewitched, saying blame it on the weatherman with a little creative lyrical help from our production team. So we turn now to WBUR meteorologist David Epstein. Dave, I'm gunning for you.
I've stepped out. Sorry.
I want to blame it on someone, Dave.
Yeah, you know, okay, so here's the thing. I think folks are spoiled. I'm going to push back a little bit. It snowed four times over an inch this winter. It's like super easy. Literally every storm that we've had over an inch has come on a Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. It hasn't been that bad.
So I had to mute myself. I was laughing so hard. I love it that you threw the glove down in return. Outstanding. Okay, so in all seriousness, is today's snow, which I'm not supposed to be unhappy about, is it almost done?
It is almost done. We'll see a coating to an inch or two here the rest of the afternoon into the early evening. It's chilly around Boston now. Temperatures back down into the 20s. We're in the 30s to the south where the snow was mixed with and even changed to rain for a time. The colder air will be taking over overnight tonight. So those of you listening south of Boston especially, if you have some slush around the area or very wet snow, try to remove it because it will get rock solid overnight tonight with the colder temperatures.
And I do actually want to give you a sound of appreciation for that. I heard you say this morning on air, this is one to clear multiple times. And obviously, I'm in the station, but my teenage kid is at home, and I called him to do that. And he actually thanked me later in the day. This is one where the wet has really come down on that snow, Dave.
Yeah, exactly. You know, some storms you can wait till the end, and it can even be more than this, but it's not so bad to remove. But this is one of those ones you're going to want to have to have cleaned up several times in order to get back down to the pavement. The good news is that the sun this time of the year, once it does return here this weekend, even with temperatures on the cold side, the sun is so strong and it heats up that black asphalt and really starts to melt things even when temperatures don't indicate melting.
So you think that we might lose most of it sometime in the next several days?
I don't think we're going to lose most of it in the next several days. I do think you'll get down to bare pavement, however.
Well, that's a
start. It's going to take a little while. Temperatures are actually going to be below average to start this upcoming month. We're going to finish February, which of course ends on Monday, on a colder than average note, and we're going to continue at or slightly colder than average right through for about the next week. So the next 7 days, I think, are going to be a little frustrating for people because it's not going to be warm. We did have the 70-degree weather, and temperatures are going to be chilly.
And January seemed very cold, too, despite the fact that, as you appropriately say, actually not that much snow.
Yeah, January was colder than average. But if you looked at the 150 Januaries, it kind of was in like the top third of cold. It wasn't one of the coldest. It was certainly in the colder half, no doubt about it. December, almost winterless. February's going to end up above average with temperatures. We'll end up with more snow than average as well. And then remains to be seen what happens in March. I don't want to talk about March 1993, where we had over 30 inches of snow. So anything can happen this upcoming month. I'm not predicting that. I'm just saying, you know, don't put away the snow shovel.
I will blame you. I just want to be clear about it right now.
All right. Fair enough.
So listen, last question on this, and I'm sure you've answered this a million times over these last couple of years. A wild temperature swing like we just got, is that just a thing, or is this us looking towards phenomena like climate change?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a fair question to ask. So the way I answer this question is that wild swings are not unusual and have always happened around New England. However, what we see is that when we get warmer in these swings, the warmth is a little warmer than it would have been 20, 30 years ago. So if you look at this year, December, January, February, meteorological winter, again, we had 10 days of 60 degrees. We probably will not have any more than that, but we had 10 days of 60 or higher. That's the highest amount we've ever seen in winter. So that doesn't mean 60 degree weather didn't occur in 1880. It did, but not as frequently. And that's the change. You're going to see more of these bump ups more frequently. And when they occur, it'll just be a little bit warmer.
Okay, so knowing what a gardener you are, turning my mind towards spring, what are you most looking forward to planting and what are you going to plant first?
So I pulled some seeds out yesterday. They are sitting on my counter. I've got some spinach and some baby kale, which I'll probably start. I like to start some things inside that are really hardy to go outside early. I'll put them maybe under cover, maybe under some plastic or milk jugs or something like that. But spinach, kales are really hardy things that can be planted early. If you're waiting to plant some things outside, onions should be started right now because they take a long time to germinate and you're going to want to get them big enough to put outside sometime in April or early May. So there are some things you can be doing this time of the year, even if you're just flipping through a catalog.
Well, I love thinking about planting. That is WBUR meteorologist David Epstein. Dave, I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, so now it is Friday, which means it's time for our Week in Review. With us this week, Joe Battenfeld, political columnist for the Boston Herald, and Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO and founder of Apex Noir Cannabis. Tito, Joe, welcome back to both of you.
Thanks, Tiziana.
And so let's talk about the weather a little bit. We're going to invite you into this conversation. Crazy winter, does it have you out there thinking about climate change? And do you think we are ready to adapt sufficiently to these changing weather patterns? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. Tito, is this driving you nuts or is it just par for the course for you?
Well, today, the nice, cold, very heavy snow that didn't want to work with my new snowblower, it is definitely driving me nuts. Now, the 70-degree weather, which got me into my T-shirt drawer, that actually made me very happy. But as Dave noted, this issue of the increase in temperatures, and in particular being a coastal city, is definitely something that we need to really think about. In particular in Boston, where we have a seaport, much of it that is pretty close to sea level. And so, you know, the thoughts of and the anticipation of sea level rising and that affecting the buildings there, but also the city of Boston and what could happen as a coastal city. So this is something that we have to be very thoughtful and proactive and actually plan now into the future to deal with.
So I am really fascinated, Joe Battenfeld, with both this idea of whether we're ready and what our new normal is. I want to play a little sound here. This is Governor Baker at a press conference yesterday evening asking Massachusetts residents to heed what was coming.
Once again, conditions for tomorrow's morning commute are going to be hazardous. If it's possible for people to stay off the roads, we would ask that they do so.
So I want to pick up on that because I get this feeling, Joe, that it just doesn't hit people the same way to be asked to stay off the roads 2 years into COVID as it did, let's say, in a 2018 or 2019. Are we sort of structured in our new COVID normal actually in some ways to better handle these big winter events? And will it lead the governor to, you know, say stay off the roads more often than when everybody had to be out?
I think it's a lot easier for people to stay off the roads now than it used to be before COVID. And I think that I still see, though, too many people out on the roads driving way too fast. It's just it's out of control. And whether it's COVID or not, people need to heed the governor's warnings and other warnings better, I think, than to, you know, jump out on their cars in 8 inches of snow or whatever. And slippery, wet snow, and it's not a good combination. And it drives me crazy when I see people driving so fast.
Well, and I do want to note, I mean, the data also supports what you're saying. We know in that first year of the pandemic, although traffic went down, highway traffic deaths didn't. We know that we've seen a spike in pedestrians being hit by automobiles. So there's an adaptation that's not happening there. Tito, you brought up, you know, the Seaport District, climate change, how vulnerable we are there. I'm also just thinking about our ability to respond to things like potholes, et cetera. We've been talking about a desire for infrastructure for, I don't know, my entire lifetime. Are we at a point where we need some massive infrastructure investment in our roads, in our low-lying areas, et cetera? And do we have the will to do it?
Yeah. So I drive a Prius, so I know about all of the potholes in every part of the city of Boston. It is absolutely critical that we take a proactive approach. Mayor Wu has obviously been pushing for increased spending relative to making the parts of the MBTA free. And we know that the free word doesn't come actually as free. It has to be paid for somehow. So that's one of the components. I think Vision Zero and the physical infrastructure around the city of Boston needs to be upgraded. I remember when I went to Amsterdam and I actually got to see what a real bike lane looks like versus cones, which is which sadly on the Mass Ave Bridge continue to get thrown into the water, that there's actual physical infrastructure that puts a barrier between cars as well as people, because that when it comes to the quote unquote zero part of Vision Zero, and that portion means that we should have zero deaths from automobiles that actually hit pedestrians or bikes. So there's a lot of work that we have to do in this older city. One of the things that I actually did get to see also when I went to Mexico City with the Barr Foundation was the center lane bus structures that were put forward there. And we can't say that we're, you know, older than the Olmecs and what was going on in Mexico City. But when it comes down to them moving 9 million people a day around, they did a really good job at something that kind of looks like the Green Line, but it's actually done based on buses. And so there's a lot of work in terms of infrastructure that we need to put into the city of Boston to make us safe and also really able to move around with the gridlock that's happening now during COVID times. We can only imagine when folks all get back up and running.
All right. So you both have laid out some serious issues there, serious issues around climate and safety and infrastructure. Because we're talking about weather, I want to be a stinker for just a minute before we go to the break and ask you the ever green or white for snow question. Space savers in parking spots? Yes or no, Joe Battenfeld?
Oh, I'm totally yes on that. If, you know, at least for the first few days, I think that people who shovel out their own spaces should have them for at least a couple days.
And Tito, what about you?
I'm right there, or I will park in Joe's space.
Oh, nice.
All right. Well,
yeah, I don't have a Prius unlike the Tito, though.
Still with us, our panelists this week, Joe Battenfeld of the Boston Herald and former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson. Our attention turns now to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which we have learned over the last 24 to 48 hours resonates really deeply here in Greater Boston. We have large Eastern European, Russian, and Ukrainian populations, echoes of the Cold War and even World War II that resonate among those who have long memories, worries among young people about what this could mean. Join the conversation. Are you worried for yourself, family, neighborhood, business? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston to join the conversation. It has been a stunning couple of days. Tito Jackson, what have you been thinking of as you've watched it unfold?
You know, I've just been first, you know, prayerful for those individuals in particular in Ukraine. We know that this is a very complex situation, in particular because the U.S. does not have an easy fix here. We know that that Putin is obviously in many ways outraged and offended and by anyone who is connected with NATO. And I think that this is, you know, the geopolitical politics that go along with this, his willingness to push through Ukraine and really put at risk the other NATO nations that are there. We also know that Ukraine turned off the water to Crimea and built a dam. And so much of the area that was previously annexed by Russia is actually not with water for the couple million folks who are there. So this is a very difficult piece. We know that the U.S. has one really big switch, which is, you know, turning off the finances through SWIFT. And that would be also very difficult based on the U.S. economy, which we know is, you know, potentially teetering on, you know, obviously we have lots of inflation and we have to have some type of correction that we don't want to overshoot. So very difficult time for everyone involved.
Yeah, the economy is a piece that we have heard people already begin to talk about, you know, for everything from gas prices to local businesses owned by Russians and Ukrainians. I do want to bring it home a little bit here. And Joe Battenfeld, I'm going to play a couple of different pieces of sound from conversations we had on our air yesterday here at Radio Boston. First, this is a caller. This is Yena, who was calling from Berlin, Massachusetts.
I was born in 1968, in Prague, just a few months before the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia, and the entire world stood by and did absolutely nothing. And I hope that this doesn't happen now. I am talking to my friends in Prague. They're afraid. And so we need to do something to stop this.
So, Joe, I was going to play another piece of sound, but I'm not because... You know, the way Yena really cried after that and the way this is resonating dramatically for people here. I think we're used to foreign affairs events feeling more foreign than this is feeling for us.
Yeah, it's very heartbreaking and unsettling to hear. And to hear Putin basically threatening to use the nuclear option is even more, you know, worrisome. And I saw a story in the Herald about a woman who lives in South Boston, Ukrainian woman, whose father, 58-year-old father, dropped everything, is in Ukraine still, dropped everything to join the Ukraine army yesterday, 58 years old. And this is what people are facing over there to defend their country. And it's just absolutely horrific.
You know, I'm thinking about listening to you talk about nuclear powers in this, which is a part of the mix. A couple of times this week, we had Massachusetts Congressman Jake Auchincloss of the 4th District on early in the week when we were kind of wondering what was going to happen. And then again yesterday when it had happened. And yesterday he told us that he didn't think the risk of nuclear war was imminent. Here he is.
It would be unwise for the United States to engage in conventional kinetic conflict with another nuclear power in Ukraine. Having said that, we can and have been providing lethal and non-lethal support to Ukrainians. We should be considering our cyber options offensively, both in Ukraine against Russian military operations in Ukraine and potentially even in the Russian homeland. And as I said, we should be waging what I think is potentially even more destabilizing information operations in the Russian homeland.
So Tito Jackson measured there, but dark stuff. And of course, cyber options, misinformation options can cut both ways. There are other ways this conflict can come home to us here in the Commonwealth.
Yeah. So, you know, we have, again, large populations of Ukrainians in and around the New England area. And my heart absolutely goes out for them. As Joe noted, we are dealing with a maniac in many regards in terms of the way in which Putin is comporting himself. I think another aspect of this, and I think one of the really important components is what we recently heard China say, which they were blaming the United States. But I think China is actually a really critical component in this. With the, One Road, the kind of Silk Road component that they have been running, I believe that there's an opportunity for them to actually weigh in, not knowing if they're going to, but there is actually an opportunity. And I think as Congressman Auchincloss spoke about this component about information and setting the record straight is a really critical component.
So another piece of this, Joe Battenfeld, is the existential level. We've heard a lot of conversation about democracy, the balance of power and peace in Europe. Even those things come home. I was struck. We heard from Michael Pipko, who lives in Newton. He lives in Newton. We heard from him yesterday. He has family in St. Petersburg, Russia. He is Russian. He's lived in the U.S. since 1993, but served in the Soviet military in the 1980s. Here he is.
I did serve in 85 to 87. That was the end of the Afghanistan war. I didn't go to Afghanistan. I was in the Zenith rocket department, which we were seeing our sky. Back then, there was a obvious enemy, and that was Ronald Reagan, and people praised Americans. The Americans were the idols. Everybody wanted to have somewhere a hidden American flag, and that's how our personalities had been split back then. And it was, for us, of all of us, it was kind of like hope and fun that one day we will be one of those. For me, it's happened. I am an American.
And that was really striking, that promise. When he was serving in, at the time in the Cold War, we would have thought our mortal enemies, military, that the dream was to come here. He's here now. There are long-term implications for freedom of movement, immigration, our relations. You know, how important is this moment? What will we be saying, you know, to the extent that we can know, Joe, 2 decades from now?
I think it's very important, especially in Europe, the previous caller was talking about people in Prague being upset about this and remember, you know, echoes of the Soviet Union back in the 1960s. I grew up in the Cold War era, and I still remember very clearly, you know, how dangerous a time it was when the Soviet Union was an empire. And now I think people don't realize how big a country Ukraine is. It really is, and it's a significant democracy that's being taken away. And so I think that's what – I think the fear is that other democracies will topple in the wake of this.
Tito, I think a lot about – I mean, there's so much more sound from this week I'd like to play. We're going to move on in a second. So just briefly to you, what kinds of acts of solidarity do you want to see from our greater Boston community right now?
I think, you know, as we have heard, aid – that, you know, needs to be sent from you know, kind of a health side of things. I think it is really important that we also provide kind of wraparound services for the individuals who are here for them to deal with the obvious mental health stresses that kind of go along with this also. And I guess the last thing I would also say, I am dumbfounded, appalled, and upset that our prior president, Donald Trump, is still playing footsie with Putin. And also that we have still, and you know, I see online Americans who are sitting kind of rooting for Russia in this at this time. And I think that is a real show of where we are as a country. And I think I hope that we can push through that, come together and root for democracy and the rule of international law.
So with that in mind, before we go to Boston Mayor Michelle Wu's 100 Days, which I'm about to do, I'm going to give the last word to Republican State Representative Leonard Mira of the 2nd Essex District on our show yesterday.
This is a time when we really need to be unified, Tiziana. We really need to be unified in opposition to this unprovoked invasion. And when I say we, I'm not just talking about the United States. I'm talking about all Western democracies. You know, this is a time when we really should get together and, you know, get our ducks in a row and work towards a common goal here.
Coverage we will continue over the next couple of weeks, I'm sure. I do want to give us a couple of minutes now to talk about Boston Mayor Michelle Wu's first 100 days, 1-800-423-8255. To join the conversation, I'm going to invite Paul in Marshfield to kick us off, actually. Paul, go ahead.
Oh, thanks, Tiziana. Yeah, I watch with interest and listen with interest in Michelle Wu's first 100 days, but I cannot imagine what it's like being in her house or living with her house with these people protesting God knows how many hours. And to be honest with you, as I told Chris, I honestly think that we didn't see this with Marty Walsh or any other mayor. I think that a lot of males that work in the fire department especially have a problem with a female minority it being in power. And it's just, I cannot believe what it must be like coming back to that. And, you know, they're just going to have to get over it.
Paul, thank you for that. I appreciate it. I'm going to give us a couple of pieces of sound here. The first, sound of protesters outside of Michelle Wu's house. And then the tenor of the messages around these protests.
You guys don't want to hear us every single day talk to your neighbor, Michelle Wu, and tell her that we should not be mandated to take a vaccine that does not work in order to keep our jobs.
That sound at around 7 o'clock in the morning, gathered by WBUR's Anthony Brooks there. Sorry, I got a message in to remind everyone, vaccines do work. We do have the data and the evidence to prove that. So there is a lot there, and there's a lot of what Paul and Marshfield said. Joe Battenfeld, let me just let you sort of pick up the ball.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there is some, you know, something to about a woman being in power and people not taking kindly to that. Although Mayor Menino, when he was mayor, had to face some pretty brutal protests from firefighters as well and some other politicians. So the firefighters in particular and some of the police unions have been pretty strong. And, you know, I hate to be the one to defend people who are clearly over the top with their protests and those piercing whistles that are awful, that are waking everybody up in the neighborhood. But people do have a right to protest. And that's part of this country. And so, you know, whether they're going too far or not, they probably are. But people do have a right to protest.
And as a reminder, Tito Jackson, you know, environmentalist protesters chained themselves into a pink boat in front of Republican male Governor Charlie Baker's home last year. So it's not the first time we've seen people encroach. And I remember teaching Saul Alinsky when I taught in social work, Tito, and one of the first moves you would make against a landlord was to spend a day protesting in front of their house.
I think that's true. I think many of these folks have definitely crossed the line. I think there is a difference between protests, and I think as noted, the prior mayors may have seen a day or two at their home, but to see literally a couple of months of this on a daily basis, I think we do need to ask about disturbing the peace. As Joe knows, I've been part of many protests, and I've actually seen multiple times where police officers have actually made the protesters move to a specific designated area. But, you know, to the attributes of Mayor Wu, this is obviously a job that about 4 years and some change ago that I interviewed for. I would say, you know, she has had a successful first 100 days. Many of the issues that she wanted to implement, in particular around transportation, the 23, the 28, and the 29, those bus lines for the next 2 years are essentially to the individuals using it going to be free. She is taking on the issues of affordable housing. She is also making, you know, her stamp on, or putting her stamp on the education component by, in essence, being able to choose the leadership that she wants there. I will note that the Boston Public Schools recently actually just had some very good data that they're actually doing better than the state in a whole host of areas. So they are longitudinally moving in the right direction. But I do believe that she also is serving at one of the hardest times ever when it comes to just all issues. And so I believe that in all, when we look at the first 100 days of Michelle Wu's, I'm not going to say campaign, it's actually her serving in office, she's done a good job. Last note, I'm sorry, is that she did also move forward with the Black Men's Commission that I put forward in 2014, and commissioners will be appointed shortly. So very, very, very good movement on those issues.
Yeah, and I want to put a note on that one, Tito Jackson. It was something I thought you might bring up today, and I do want to let all our listeners know, on Monday, we will actually be spending most of the hour with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. Her new initiatives, including that one, are some of the things we're looking forward to asking her when we talk to her on Monday, and she will take your calls. So do make an appointment with yourself to tune in at 3 o'clock on Monday, where we will have Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. Tito, I appreciate sort of you laying out the landscape of those first 100 days, including talking education. So staying on that, Joe Battenfeld, for a minute, I'll be a little cheesy and ask you, what grade do you give her first 100 days?
I think it has to be an incomplete. I hate to bail out that way, but the fact that, I mean, the 100 days deadlines are always somewhat artificial, but especially now where it takes so long to get things accomplished. But I basically think if you like Michelle Wu, then you think she's doing a really good job and point to the successes that she's made. If you're not a big fan of Michelle Wu, people are going to view it as a failure. And I think the fact that she is going to be picking a new superintendent and will have basically put her own stamp on the schools is really the big test that she's going to face coming forward. There's a lot of dissatisfaction still in the Boston school system. People want an elected school committee now. They don't want an appointed school committee. So she is going to have to deal with this going forward. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so you say it's a really big test, Joe. So how do you know if she's passed the test? How will you know?
Well, I think depending on who the new next superintendent is and, you know, what kind of job they do. Obviously, it's a hard thing just to turn around the schools in just 100 days. You can't do that. But within a year or so, a year and a half, maybe, you could probably, you know, tell whether test scores are going up or whether she's scrapping some of these tests that have been taking place, too. So, you know, there's a lot to judge on.
So with that specifically in mind, Tito Jackson, Joe just said there's a lot to judge on. And this is one of the things I wanted to ask you both. So what are the open questions for you, Tito?
Well, you know, she still has to continue to build out her team, as Joe just noted, in addition to the superintendent. And I do want to give, some props to Brenda Casilius. The Boston schools dropout rate was
current
was
superintendent,
cut in,
just for listeners. Current,
yeah, and the, it w- was cut in half. And she got here. She's been here for 3 years. And well over two of those years was spent under COVID. So she was here under very difficult circumstances. So I think there's that component. I think the area of the police commissioner is one of the other decision points that has to be made. There is a very well-regarded committee that is kind of dealing with that issue. I think the overarching difficult issue of affordable housing and then also the issues of homelessness in and around the Mass Ave area. And then the summer is fast approaching. And so the issue of violence that occurs throughout the summertime and the fact that we have several $100 million of ARPA funds, which are stimulus dollars from the feds, that we should be proactively spending around summer youth jobs, as well as creative methods in violence prevention to make sure that we actually continue the trend of actually cutting the major crime in the city of Boston, which actually happened last year also.
ARPA being the American Rescue Plan Act. So, Joe Battenfeld, before we go to our hubbubs, let me turn to you and just ask you, what's on your punch list of open questions?
To Mayor Wu?
Yes. In sort of evaluating what's coming next for her, what kind of job she's going to do, what are you watching for?
I think the police and how she deals with the city unions coming up is going to be a big test for her. That's what I want to find out. She's already caved slightly to the teachers' union, and she's been tough against some of the other unions. But this is a problem that all Boston mayors have had to face, and I'd like to see her stand up to some of these unions and be really tough against them.
And when you say cave to the teachers' union, you mean when she allowed for teachers to test instead of being vaccinated?
Exactly.
And then be out with sick time during peak. COVID yes. times. Okay. All right. So from that, I do want to leave a little bit of time for our hubbubs, which are those little local stories that caught our attention this week. Joe, I was just talking to you, so let me turn right back to you. Did you bring us a hubbub this week?
Well, whether we like it or not, the St. Patrick's Day roast is coming back. it's sort of a tradition that has sort of gone past its prime, I think. But they're, after a two-year absence, the roast is coming back in person. And the parade is also coming back in person. And so people can go out. It's a shortened route. It's not the same route that they usually take. But at least it's some parade. I know people were very upset when the parade was cut out during COVID. So now they can go out and celebrate or whatever, do whatever they want. I've never been a big parade guy myself or a big roast guy, but it is coming. And, you know, so get those really bad jokes out, politicians, because you're going to need them.
Well, it kind of, it's almost traumatic to hear because I just have these visions of we keep thinking something's going to happen, then it gets canceled, then it gets, you know, I feel like we're tempting fate. But so far, so good there. Okay, thank you, Joe. What about you, Tito?
Well, one, I want to wish everybody a happy Black History Month. And we are, as a country, I believe, you know, moving forward, acknowledging that. My hubbub actually does not have to do with that. It has to do with helicopters that were in the sky earlier this week. I actually live right near Franklin Park, and I believe Joe lives not too far from Franklin Park on the other side. Tiziana, someone went into the zoo and decided to not actually take the typical route in the zoo. There was an individual, I believe that a gentleman was from Worcester, who decided to try to get into the tiger cage.
Sorry.
So we do, as residents of Boston, for those individuals who visit, we would ask that when you visit the Franklin Park Zoo, that you look at, in particular, tigers as well as lions from behind the fence and not get too close.
I'm sorry. So wait, the helicopters were like trying to find the guy. Did he get into the tiger cage?
Yeah. So this is the environmental thing. I think he did get pretty close to the tiger cage. And I'm very glad that the amazing folks at the Franklin Park Zoo staff were able to stop him from meeting the tiger and the conversation that would have ensued had that occurred.
That's right.
So,
well, I'm a fan of animal hubbubs, but that is a whole new level. All right, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, now CEO of Apex Noir Cannabis, and Joe Battenfeld, political columnist for the Boston Herald. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
Thank you.
Every day when you're walking down the street, and everybody that you meet.
Oh, no, I don't want it to end. My feet are tippy-tapping for parents, kids, listeners, young and old. That song is beloved and instantly recognizable. It is the theme song from the animated PBS kids show Arthur, which came to a close this week after 25 years on the air. With hundreds of episodes, watchers got to know Arthur, his family, his third-grade classmates, his neighbors. And now we're all saying goodbye. So here with us to help send Arthur off properly is Carol Greenwald, executive producer of the series. Carol, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So is it a happy closure? Is it a bittersweet closure? Is it sad, Carol?
Well, first of all, I just want to say Arthur is not going anywhere. Arthur's going to be on PBS for years to come. As you mentioned, we have hundreds of episodes, and they will be continue to air on PBS, and we'll have new viewers who grow into the series and who will be able to watch it with their parents and older siblings who enjoy the series. And we're also going to be available on new platforms. We're going to have a podcast that's going to be produced this year, and we're going to be creating additional shorts, which is something we started during the pandemic, where Arthur and his friends talk about things that are of interest to them and to parents and kids.
So, you know, kids grow up. They change. They mature. You just pointed out that this is a show that's been on the air for 25 years. It's probably going to run in reruns for two more decades. That's generations and generations of kids. What is it about Arthur that gives him such longevity?
Well, that is the question, isn't it? I always think it's the authenticity of it, that one of our goals with the show is to make the kids feel very real and not to have them feel like they're perfect, so that every kid watching the show could see themselves represented. And we also did a lot of work to try to make it feel inclusive, so that there were a lot of kids who had different kinds of families, who lived in different kinds of neighborhoods, who had different life experiences. And our hope was always that a kid could watch the show and say, oh, that's me. It might be an aardvark, it might be a bulldog, it might be a rabbit, but, you know, you could see yourself.
You know, you said, you used the word authenticity a minute ago, and I want to pick up on that. I'm going to play a little sound here between Arthur and his little sister, DW, a moment that kind of embodies sibling energy.
I can be your partner for the next race.
Sorry, Sue Ellen. It's a brother and sister race. Maybe there's a contest for lonely children after this. It's only children, DW. A lonely child is what you're going to be when I sell you.
So when producer Sarah Leeson, when we were talking about this today, and I said, you know, what does your heart want to come out in this conversation? She said the authenticity of the sibling relationship really spoke with her. And that, I mean, that's how my brothers would have talked to me. That's how my sisters would have talked to me. I was a little sister. And these were adults producing the show. How did you lock in so well to what is real to kids?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, Mark Brown set us up fabulously with his series of books. I mean, DW was there, was based on his three sisters all into one character. So she really packed a punch. But also, you know, we had kids, we were kids. We really tried to tap into those experiences. And one of my things was I really wanted a kid to see themselves and not feel like, oh, I can't be like that person. I mean, my kids bickered, I will say, all the time. Not all the time, maybe. And I will say, once I was at a party and a woman came up to me, this was quite early, and said, well, I'm in Wellesley Mothers against Arthur. And I was like, oh my gosh, why? She said, my children never bickered until they watched Arthur. And I thought, oh wow, either I am a terrible mom or... you know, maybe we're not seeing exactly what's there, but
kids grew up a little and started bickering.
That could have happened too. But kids are imperfect, and they actually learn from that imperfection. When they make a mistake or they screw up, it's that process of doing that helps them to become a better person, to become their best self. And that's something that I would love to have kids feel like they get from Arthur.
You know, you mentioned Mark Brown, who is a local author, and I wondered if you can tell us, how active was he in creating episodes, scripting over this 25 years? Has he been an active partner the whole time?
Yes, he's certainly been an active partner. You know, there were 25 books when we started, but we also had to figure out how to create an animated show based on a picture book. And if you look at a picture book, there's quite a lot there, but there's also a lot that's not there. So we had to figure out, how does Arthur walk? How does he run? What do Arthur's parents do for a living? Who are all these other kids in the classroom, some of whom didn't even have names? They were just images. But the great thing about 25 years is that you get to have that experience and build on it to be able to build nuance over time.
So, you know, I'm also really struck. Arthur is a children's program and also a boundary pusher. You know, we saw Arthur's teacher, Mr. Ratburn, get married to another man. There was an episode about understanding a new autistic friend. Here's sound from a recent short online about wearing masks.
You really think someone would do that? Just go on.
I need to grab my purse and I'm ready.
Do you have your mask? You're gonna wear a mask, right?
People need masks, Francine.
If you're going out in public, you 100% need a mask.
You know, earlier in this show, we were just talking about the massive protests here in Boston over COVID policies. You took controversy head on, and it sounds like you didn't think kids needed to be protected. And I believe me, I'm not saying that one needs to be protected from a new autistic friend, but from taking on tough issues, taking things that made people scared or intimidated heads on, introducing kids to differences. This was a brave part of the show. And I guess I'm assuming it's because you think kids are brave and capable.
I think kids are really good, smart. We cannot talk down to them. Otherwise, you just lose the whole connection. People will say, well, you should protect kids from things, but not all kids can be protected from everything. And many kids experience all of these things firsthand. And I think the rest of the kids appreciate learning about them. One of the things that we learned from our advisors was that it's important to talk about difference, but it's also so that you can see it and understand it.
And
most
yourself.
Kids will just find it interesting. But it's also important to see how people connect. And that's what we tried to do with all of our characters.
And it felt like you were helping kids see themselves, too.
And that, too, because we wanted every kid to be able to see themselves there. So that whether it was an autistic kid, and we know we have a lot of autistic kids in our audience. One of my favorite stories is about the fact that when we did Arthur's Eyes, the very first episode, we got letters from kids who were blind who said it was so exciting to see someone with glasses on TV. And we thought, wow, okay, that's amazing that little thing we did can make such a difference. Let's have a blind character. So very early on, we created Marina, who was Prunella's friend, and she was blind, and she continued throughout the whole 25 seasons. And having 25 seasons allows you to build a lot of nuance, give characters a lot of depth, and you can really get to know them.
So, you know, Arthur took on a bit of a second life, sometimes a political life, an iconic life. There's the meme of Arthur's clenched fist. And then there were moments like these.
You really think someone would do that? Just go on the internet and tell lies?
That sign can't stop me because I can't read.
How do you get square balloons?
Blow square breaths.
So this life well beyond the children's show and for kids, are you comfortable with Arthur and the other characters occupying that space as well?
Oh my gosh, I love that young adults and kids and teenagers feel like Arthur's still that meaningful to them. I was actually talking to your engineer about this earlier today, and he said he loved the fist. And I said, well, you know what I feel like about the fist is it's Arthur's trying to control his anger, and all kids get angry. And being able to figure out what to do with your anger is really important. So I'm so happy that people feel like the fist helps them to portray their anger and to think about their anger, because that's important.
All of the characters are animals. So before we let you go, I have two questions. How do you pick the animal for the character, and what animal would you be?
Oh, I'm not sure I can answer the second question, but I can tell you that the first one was, well, first of all, many of the characters were already designed. Mark really gave us a big world to work with. But one of the fun things was when we would have guest stars saying, okay, do you care what animal you are? Do you see yourself as a different animal? And they'd all be like, we don't know. And so then Mark or our designers, you know, or our director would come up with an image. And somehow it always was perfect. I don't know how he did it, but it was somehow always perfect. I mean, I will always now see Yo-Yo Ma as a rabbit. It's funny that way.
And thank you, because now so will I. And there's our challenge to listeners for the weekend. Have a conversation in your family, your household. What Arthur animals would you be? All right, Carol Greenwald, executive producer on the longtime running series Arthur, which ended in its first iteration this week. Carol, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you can catch those last few episodes streaming now on PBS Kids. That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering, glad to be with you today. Please join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.